G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letter U.org. It's season two of Torah Pills. I'm Jono, and joining me in the virtual Truth to You studio all the way from Ireland is Jason of spiritualbabies.net. G'day, mate.
G'day. It's just you and me this week.
It's you and I in the studio. There's no one else. Tovia is. Where's Tovia? He's in the Philippines teaching Torah at the moment.
That's right. And then no one else wanted to come out to play this week.
No, it's such short notice. So it's you and I, and we're in a pretty epic Torah portion too. We are in Emor, which extends from Leviticus chapter 21 to chapter 25, almost the end of 24.
Yep, and it's it includes a lot of different themes. So it's going to be interesting to go through. I mean, it really, and sometimes it just seems to change direction at all. But there is one big overriding theme, and we can wrap that up at the end. But maybe we should just crack in. As there's only two of us, and as we don't have Toby's inclusion this week, well, it should all be over in 15 minutes.
We should be able to do this in about 10 minutes. Yeah, let's see how we go. This is Torah Pearls Unplugged. It begins like this. It says, "And the Lord said to Moses, speak to the priests, the son of Aaron, and say to them, none shall defile himself for the dead among his people, except for his relatives who are nearest him, his mother, his father, his son, his daughter, his brother, his, also his virgin sisters who is near to him or has no husband. For her he may defile himself. Otherwise, he shall not defile himself, being the chief man among his people to profane himself. They shall not make any bald patches on their heads, nor shall they shave the edges of their beards or make any cuttings in their flesh." Now we've read that before, haven't we? Because in Leviticus 19:27, I think it was, it says, "You shall not." We did the talk about the tattoo. We didn't talk about the beard.
Yeah, because the same people would sometimes pull the hair out of their head as a sign of grief. What I want to ask you, though, is what you get from verse 4, "But a husband should not defile himself for a wife who causes his desecration."
So I've got in verse 4, "Otherwise he shall not defile himself, being a chief man among his people to profane himself." What you're saying, that for his wife he cannot attend the funeral?
Yeah, I've got in mine, so I'm reading today. I try to read from a different one every week. So today I'm on Chabad.org, and I'm reading from their Torah reading, their passages this week. And it says, and so there are some things are in brackets. So it's what's inferred in the text. "A husband should not defile himself for his desecration among his people." That's what it says in the text. But the added text to that is, "But a husband shall not defile himself for a wife who causes his desecration while she is among his people."
So, okay, so now you've got me reading from the Jewish Study Bible, and it says in verse 4, "But he shall not defile himself as a kinsman by marriage and so profane himself."
If he has a wife who was somehow unworthy to him, that she was unfit to marry him, and that normally means that this priest has married a widow, there's a category of people that a high priest can't marry. Now, if he chooses to marry into that category and she dies, he can't then deal with her and her body as he would have been able to do if she hadn't caused his desecration. So if he'd have married a virgin and that virgin then dies, he can deal under this clause, because, you know, he can deal with his closest relatives. He could deal with that. But this woman, he wasn't supposed to marry in the first place. And if she dies, he can't deal with her body if she has family members that can do it for him, which is why it finishes off while she is, in the context, among his people. Now, wow. I think the alternate to that is that if she doesn't have any family, he has to, because, you know, it's a bigger thing not to bury the dead than it is to it's more important to bury the dead than to avoid it becoming clean. But that's what's going on there, and you'll find that desecration word coming up a lot in this first chapter. And the desecration basically means that the person who is desecrated is impure in some way because of their acts, and it's normally a sexual thing, but we'll pull them out as we go along.
Mm. It goes on, verse 6, they shall be holy to their God and not profane the name of their God, for they offer the offering of the Lord made by fire and the bread of their God, therefore they shall be holy. They shall not take a wife who is a harlot or a defiled woman.
I see, there we go, right? Okay, so in this text it says, they shall not marry a woman who is a prostitute. And what's interesting there is that the word doesn't really mean prostitute. It doesn't say prostitute. It infers a woman who has lived with a person or persons that they aren't married to. Or in some instances I've read that it's a Gibeonite. Or there's a whole load of different people who later, obviously this is written before, but later fall under this category. But in this instance, it's not necessarily a prostitute, but it is someone who may have slept around. Doesn't mean they took money for it. Mm. Slept around is very harsh, isn't it? Well, they had they could have had a series of perfectly legitimate relationships with people when that went too far. But it doesn't always mean prostitute when you read prostitute. But the text continues, or who is desecrated. So a woman who was born, and I'm looking up the notes here, I'm from Rashi, a woman who was born from one who is unfit for kahuna. So a woman who was born from one who is not able to, I think kahuna refers to the food that comes from the holy sacrifices, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if a desecrated person is someone that can't eat from those, and if a priest marries one of these women, she's a desecrated woman, and any children that come from that union are also desecrated. They're a holy part of Israel, but there are some things they can't get involved with, and there are some kind of results from your involvement with one of those people.
And adding to that list, it goes on to say, nor shall they take a woman divorced from her husband. And it says, for the priest is holy to his God. So what that means is that a Kohen cannot marry a divorced woman.
Right.
Okay, there it is. Therefore you shall consecrate him, for he offers the bread of your God. He shall be holy to you, for I, the Lord who sanctify you, am holy.
That for me, that's a really interesting line. So you shall sanctify him. So he's saying to Israel, you are going to consider this priest or these priests to be set apart from you. You're going to kind of make them holy to you. For he is the one that offers up the food offerings to your God. I think actually in the text, it might even say God's food. He offers up God's food for you. Mm-hmm. He shall be holy to you. For I, the creator, am the one who sanctifies you. And I'm holy.
And I'm holy.
That blows your mind. It's like this big circle of holy going on. And God's saying, I do this to you. You're going to do that to him because he does something for me. And
he holds a high office, representative of God, and as a result of that, he needs to be considered and seen to be set apart.
Right, which means that these people had these priests. They did these holy things for people as regards to the sacrifices and rituals. They weren't elite among the people, but they were to be considered a step up. Like you said, they weren't just a separate group. They weren't just a set apart group. They were elevated from everybody else because if you want to approach God, we look at the sacrifices that come on later on when we talk about what is and isn't acceptable. When you offer something to God, they have to be as perfect as possible, and you have to keep them as clean as possible. And that goes for the priests too. Their lives were an offering for God, if you want to look at it that way. And it might cause some issues for people who, Isaiah 53 always comes up, and the idea that a person can't offer themselves to God as a sacrifice. Mm. But you can certainly give your life to the service of God, right?
Mm.
Which is an example of how to keep yourself and how the priests keep themselves kind of ritually pure and clean is what this whole chapter is about.
Mm, yeah, this specifically pertains to the Kohen. And verse 9 is a really controversial one, Jason. This is, it says, the daughter of any priest, if she profanes herself by playing the harlot, she profanes her father, she shall be burned with fire.
Mm, it's a tough call, isn't it? I had a conversation with someone the other day, and they said, so do you believe in stoning? And I said, well, I've never seen anyone get stoned because of the Torah. And but the response there is, well, you know, when the Messiah comes, are we not going to go back to the ways of the Torah? That could be a thing. And what I try to remember is, yes, we will. I mean, if that's the truth, if when Messiah comes and the whole world knows Torah and the whole world accepts God as the only God, and everyone understands the Torah and takes it on their heart, and some people rebel, and the cost of that rebellion is to be stoned, then that's that world. That's God's rules. And although, you know, we're not always there to, we can't question that. And the same thing's happening here. Although it says for adultery, this isn't just any daughter that goes off and kind of plays around. This is a married woman, or a woman who's promised, a betrothed woman, who has an extra relationship and makes herself unclean, if you like. But that desecrates her father. That word desecrate comes up a lot.
Are you saying that this woman in verse 9 is betrothed? Where do we get that from?
Because you can't commit adultery unless you are already part of a pair.
Now, where are you getting adultery from? Because in my New King James, I'm reading, and it says, if she profanes herself by playing the harlot, she profanes her father. But playing the harlot isn't necessarily adultery, right?
That's interesting, because I'm reading, if a Cohen's daughter becomes desecrated through adultery, she desecrates her father and she'll be burned in the fire.
Ah, okay, let me go to another translation. So this is verse 9, and again, referring to the Jewish Study Bible, and it says, when the daughter of a priest defiles herself through harlotry, it is her father whom she defiles, she shall be put to the fire. What translation are you looking at?
I'm looking at the Chabad one, but you know what? I can have a look and just see what words are used there.
While you do that, I'm going to look at my art scroll. This is 21 verse 9. Okay, so I've got, in the art scroll it says, if a daughter of a Kohen will be desecrated through adultery, she desecrates her father, she shall be consumed by fire.
So I've got I'm looking at a whole series of different translations now, you know, a lot of English Christian translations say profanes herself by harlotry. Harlotry is very popular among the Christian translations. But what's that word really mean? Let's have a little look. Strong's Hebrew 2181. It says harlot and plays the harlot. All right, unfaithful, commit adultery, adulteress. So there's plenty of instances where this does mean adultery. This actually brings up something else that came up today. It's quite interesting. There's a very long thread on my page at the moment as a result of a graphic that I put up where a lady who's kind of seeking answers has been asking questions, and people have been trying to respond, some more respectfully than others. But it's really about that her questions are about uses of certain words in certain passages. For example, the word guilt. Now, guilt used in the Torah, we can often read in our English guilt offering, but the word offering won't be in the text because the context of the chapter we're talking about is talking about offerings. And so it will say when you bring a guilt. It won't say when you bring a guilt offering. Although when we go back to Genesis 29, I think, 20 verse 9, something along those lines, the word guilt is used, and it's exactly the same word, but in no way infers a guilt offering in Genesis' use. And I said to her, if I was to say to you, can you pick the pink one, and we were eating marshmallows, it would mean something very different to me sending her off to a clothes store to buy a T-shirt.
Right.
Now, for someone to come along 2,000 years later and try to claim that a marshmallow and a T-shirt are the same thing because they both are used with the word pink, it just shows how important it is to go to the context of a word and its use.
Fair enough. Well, that's a curious one. So that's verse 9. I'm going to throw that out to the listeners and see what they return on that in the comments section. Mm. That would be great. Verse 10, he who is the high priest among his brethren, on whose head the anointing oil was poured and who is consecrated to wear the garments, shall not uncover his head nor tear his clothes, nor shall he go near any dead body, nor defile himself for his father or his mother. Defile himself for his father or his mother?
Yeah, so if I think that means if his parents died, he is unable to attend the body. Well, that must be very difficult to do.
Yeah. Amazing. It goes on, nor shall he go out of the sanctuary, nor profane the sanctuary of his God, for the congregation, for the consecration of the anointing oil of his God is upon him. I am the Lord. And if he takes, now, by the way, that reminds us, of course, of the situation that Aaron found himself in when his two sons were consumed by fire for offering strange fire before the Lord. And we read about that only a few chapters before. And he shall take a wife in her virginity, a widow or a divorced woman or a defiled woman or a harlot. These he shall not marry, but he shall take a virgin of his own people as a wife. Nor shall he profane his posterity among his people, for I, the Lord, sanctify him.
Oh, when we get go back to verse 14, a widow, a divorcee, a woman who is desecrated, or a prostitute, he shall not marry any of these. Only a woman, only a virgin of his people. Maybe may he take as a wife. We have to ask why, why that? And I think the answer here is that the offspring of this priest, any male here, is going to be a priest. And so they more than ever, the kind of the lineage, the bloodstock of this family needs to be kept as pure as possible. And so if you look at the options here, a widow would have had a husband, possibly kids already. And so what, you know, how long ago did that husband die? Could she already be pregnant? We see other instances in the Torah where the possibility that a woman may already carry a child can even lead to their death when Israel invades surrounding countries and lands. A divorcee, it's the same issue. A woman who is desecrated, so she by default can't have children that are going to be pure enough to be priests. And the prostitute, or someone who has kind of a history of being very forward in their affections, same story. And the virgin is the only one that he can be sure of producing, I don't want to say purebred because that sounds really harsh, but producing children who are of no other lineage other than the Kohanim.
And doesn't it really oh man, the more you read of this, the more you realize that the higher the office, the more set apart you have to be. And it's a high bar, isn't it?
Utterly, yeah.
Okay, so it goes on, verse 16, and the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to Aaron saying, no man of your descendants in succeeding generations who has any defects may approach to offer the bread of his God. For any man who has a defect shall not approach, a blind man or lame, he who has marred face or a limb too long. If a man who has a broken foot or a broken hand, or he's a hunchback or a dwarf, or a man who has a defect in his eye, eczema, a scab, or as a eunuch, no man of the descendants of Aaron, the priest, who has a defect shall come near to offer the offerings made by fire to the Lord. He has a defect.
I have to jump in there real quick.
Go on.
I don't have any mention of a dwarf or a, what's the other one you had?
I've got a hunchback or a dwarf. This is what I've got. Okay, so I've got that in verse 20. Okay, so let's double check another translate. What do you have?
I have 19 through 20, a man with a broken leg or a broken arm. And then in 20, or one with long eyebrows. Apparently that's not you. Or a cataract.
Wait a minute. Are you serious? You've got someone with long eyebrows.
Yeah, right. So
long eyebrows is a defect.
Yeah, they're abnormally long and droop over the eyes. Or a cataract, right? Or
have you ever met anybody with eyebrows so long that they droop over the eyes?
Well, check this one out. Or a cummingling in his eyes.
What's that?
Apparently, it's like a light defect. So the white of his eye will go into the color and into the blackness of his eye. So it's like an eye defect. You get it in animals. I've seen it in animals before, but never in a human. Sorry if you're listening to this and you've got one of those.
Oh, no. Listen to this. So this is what I've got in my... This is terrible. Oh, the Jewish Study Bible, once again. It's got, this is verse 20, who is a hunchback or a dwarf, or who has a growth in his eye, oh my goodness, or who has a boil scar, or scurvy, or crushed testes.
Yeah, I have the. I don't have the crushed testicles, but the text that's here right. has the crushed testicles. That's not the only pair of crushed testicles that are going to happen in this story portion.
Are you serious? How do people end up with crushed testicles? I don't want to know. Let's not dwell on that.
I don't think it means okay. crushed. I think more likely it's that there's an abnormality. There's a problem with those testicles. And again, you know, you might have a perfectly great body and a beautiful face, but, you know, the testicles are, that's, you know, that's your manliness. It's your part of it anyway, I think. And, you know, perhaps this is, again, to do with producing... producing offspring that are going to be a perfect picture of a human form that can go up to serve God in his sanctuary. And perhaps testicle is going to be an issue with kids.
Yeah, it might be. I don't know that that is specifically the issue. I think it's more the representation of perfection within
who's going to see them?
The sanctuary.
I understand a dodgy eyeball or... you know, a lanky arm, but you're not going to be going, look how perfect I am. Here are my testicles. I mean, who's going to see?
Man, if he's got eyebrows that are hanging over his eyes, everyone's going to see that. But but listen, I've had conversations with atheists that are really angry. Don't you love it? People who don't believe in God, who are angry at God that they don't believe in for verses like this. And look, at a glance, I can appreciate that they come to the conclusion that the God they don't believe in is not fair, or he doesn't like people with defects or something like that. But really, looking at the context and understanding the context of what is being said here, it's the high bar of the priesthood. The Kohen must represent God. God is holy. God is perfect. God is sanctified. He must have perfection and set apartness in his sanctuary, operating in his sanctuary. And this is merely what it's saying. It's not as if the person who has the eyebrows that are hanging down over their eyes has done something wrong. That's not what it's saying. But what it's saying is that he requires holiness and that, you know, and the representation of such. Now, I've got in verse 20 in the art scroll, it does say, or who has abnormally long eyebrows, a membrane on his eye, or a blemish in his eye, or a dry skin eruption, or a moist skin eruption, or has crushed testicles. Okay.
Mm. That's nearly what I have here. Now, it's kind of interesting with what you just said with people that have an issue when they read the text and they think, well, you know, God must be a bit of an elitist, right? I mean, he's kind of breeding humans to have one, you know, perfect line of human, and everyone else is a subpar if they're not a priest, or if there are people in that priestly family that aren't good enough to serve God, that God doesn't care for them. But we are looking at the beginning here specifically says, any man among your offspring for other generations who has a defect shall not come near to offer up God's food. That's what it says. But when we scoot down now to 21, any man among Aaron the Cohen's offspring who has a defect shall not draw near to offer up God's fire offerings. There is a defect in him. He shouldn't draw up the fire offering. But then he can eat.
Bread.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's just the work they can't do, but the eating of that they can do.
Yeah, of course. Both the most holy and the holy, it says, only he shall not go near the veil or approach the altar because he has a defect, lest he profane my sanctuaries, for I, the Lord, sanctify them. And Moses told it to Aaron and his sons and to all the children of Israel. And that ends chapter 21. Chapter 22. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his sons that they separate themselves from the holy things of the children of Israel, and that they do not profane my holy name by what they dedicate to me. Mm-hmm. I am the Lord. Say to them, whoever of all your descendants throughout your generations who goes near the holy things which the children of Israel dedicate to the Lord, while he has uncleanness upon him, that person shall be cut off from my presence. I am the Lord. Whatever man of the descendants of Aaron who is a leper or who has a discharge shall not eat the holy offerings until he is clean. Now, obviously, we've got leper there. I dare say that's referring to the, quote, leprosy that we were talking about in chapter, what's that, chapter 13 and chapter 14, not actually leprosy, right?
That's exactly, yeah. It's tira, which is exactly the same etymology as Tazria, which we were reading through a couple weeks ago.
And whoever touches anything made unclean by a corpse or a man who has had an emission of semen, or whoever touches any creeping thing by which he would be made unclean, or any person by whom he would become unclean, whatever his uncleanness may be, the person who has touched any of these things shall be unclean until evening, and he shall not eat of the holy offerings unless he washes his body with water. So he has to be in a clean state to basically eat that which is holy, right?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of cool. You know, the priests are busy all day. They're taking in all this food for people, and they're sacrificing it in the right way, and it's getting divided up and given back to the people, some of it, and some of it is the priest's share. And so there's no long term, no one's going hungry here. At the end of the day, the priests have done their thing. These people can repent whatever they need to repent. They can go and immerse themselves in that flowing water that they have to immerse themselves in, and then they can go and eat just like everybody else. You know, the slate is set back to zero, and they're all good.
Now, here's something kind of weird. What do you make of this? Verse 8, whatever dies naturally or is torn by a beast, he shall not eat it. He being the Kohen, they can't eat that to defile himself with it. I am the Lord. But if you go back to, what is it, chapter 17, I think? Let's just go back there for a second. It's not too far. And verse 15. And it says, and every person who eats what died naturally or what was torn by beasts, whether he is a native born of your country or a stranger, he shall both wash his clothes and bathe in water and be clean until evening, and then he'll be clean. Well, does that mean they can, but the priest can't?
No, they can't either, can they? I mean, no one can eat a found dead animal. It's getting repeated here, all right, for the priests. They're getting the same instruction twice, which, you know, and that happens a few times in this as well. The priests will get told explicitly something that Israel's already been told. But it's my understanding that if an animal is found dead, whether its body is torn or not, an Israelite can't eat that, but they can sell it to, you know, here we go, that separation between alien and stranger. They can't sell it to the stranger.
Gentile Jimmy down the road.
They can give it to the, well, not even the, you know, because it's the thing with the word like Gentile, it kind of captures everybody in it. So within Israel, at any point here, you have the Israelites and you have the stranger who lives within their gates. And these,
so you can give it to the stranger?
No, you can't, but you can give it to the alien that's outside the gates. I think that's the way it works.
All right, so this is what it says in Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 21. Mm-hmm. You shall not eat anything that dies of itself. Now, there it is. That's an absolute statement. Don't eat anything that dies of itself. I mean, if it dies of itself or it's torn by a beast, it may still contain the blood if it wasn't killed in such a way that it drains. I can't possibly think of anything more disgusting. I mean, every now and then we would come out and we'd find, a duck or a chicken that's been taken out by a fox. Mm. There's no way in the world I would consider eating that. Anyway, you shall not eat anything that dies of itself. You may give it to the alien who is within your gates.
All right, so the alien within the gates isn't the same as the stranger within the gates.
That he may eat it, or you can sell it to a foreigner, for you are a holy people to the Lord. Look, foreigner, I've got a duck that was mauled by a fox, and it's going cheap for $5. What do you reckon?
There are restaurants right now in the U.S. that only sell roadkill.
No.
Yes, true. No. And they're very popular. You know,
and they're popular.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they'll say, "I know what the cause of death is." It's a semi-articulated lyric. I think for me, the issue here is that you don't know whether that animal was killed through disease, old age, poison. The animal that ate it, did it have rabies? I mean, you really don't know. And how that's okay for someone else to eat, but not for you to eat. Is difficult until you go back to where we are. We are in a book that is telling a nation how to be different to other nations. And so what if, like, supposing, because people have come to me with this before, supposing we started this Torah and it said, I, the Lord your God, have given Moses this Torah to preach to every nation of the earth. that you all do the same thing. That's not what happens. There's a, you know, these people are set apart for whatever reason, because they have to kind of go through the ringer to become the people who at a later stage will have learnt from life's lessons enough about the human nature, how to be a light to the nations. And I think what's happening here is God is saying, look, there are nations that are going to eat this, so let them eat it.
I'm still reeling at your statement that there are roadkill diners in the States.
That's true.
Are you serious? If there's anyone who lives near one or you know anything about it, you're in the States, can you write in the comments and give us the details on that? Because I find that, I wish I could say I find that difficult to believe, but there's something in me that says it's probably true.
Yeah, today we're doing squirrel. That's really true, I'm telling you. They go and they see something on the side of the road, they scrape it up with a shovel, and it's on the barbecue.
I don't want to know. Okay, they shall learn, verse 9, they shall therefore keep my ordinances, lest they bear the sin of it and die thereby. If they profane it, I, the Lord, sanctify them. No outsider shall eat of the holy offering. One who dwells with the priest or a hired servant shall not eat of the holy things. But if the priest buys a person with his money, he may eat it.
Right, check this out. It's very interesting, right? 10, no non-Cohen may eat holy things. A Cohen's resident and his hireling may not eat holy things. 11, and if a Cohen acquires a person, an acquisition through his money, he may eat of it. And those born in his house may eat the food. So in 10, a hireling may not eat it. But in 11, someone the Cohen owns may eat it.
Mm.
Doesn't that blow your mind? I mean, the hireling is someone who the Cohen doesn't own but does work for them.
Yep.
But the Cohen who owns a slave, that slave can eat it. Even though chances are that slave might be a foreign person and the hireling, possibly an Israelite.
Mm, all right. Yeah, well, that's what it says. If the priest's daughter is married to an outsider, she may not eat of the holy things. But if the priest's daughter is a widow or is divorced and has no children and has returned to her father's house in her youth, she may eat her father's food, but no outsider shall eat it. And if a man eats the holy offering unintentionally, then he has to restore a holy offering to the priest and add one-fifth to it. They shall not profane the holy offerings of the children of Israel, which they offer to the Lord, or allow them to bear the guilt of trespass when they eat their holy offerings. I am the Lord who sanctify them. It goes on to say in verse 17, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his sons and to all the children of Israel and say to them, whatever man of the house of Israel or of the strangers in Israel who offers his sacrifice for any of his vows or any of his free will offerings, which they offer to the Lord as a burnt offering, you shall offer of your own free will a male without blemish from the cattle, from the sheep. There we go. Or from the goats. Whatever is a defect you shall not offer, it shall not be acceptable. It won't be accepted on your behalf.
18 is a really awesome verse because it tells us something which isn't as obvious in much of the rest of this part of the Torah. And that is that there was a difference in the text between the house of Israel and the strangers among Israel who offer up sacrifices. So, I mean, there are a lot of people who perhaps think, well, I don't come from the house of Israel. The house of Israel being one of the 12 descendants of Jacob. That's not me, right? I don't have that surname. I don't have that lineage. But we have the strangers among Israel, those people that live within that community. I mean, often the text will say that there's one Torah for the Israelite from the house of Israel and for the stranger who dwells within the gates. And here we've got an example of that stranger that dwells within the gates, that lives among Israel, who can offer up sacrifices for their vows, who can give, it says donations here, but their free will offering. I think that's just so awesome because we don't often see in the text positive movements. You know, we see that the law, the Torah, is equal for the Israelite and for the stranger, but when it comes to like physically doing things to promote your praise and worship of God, that doesn't come up too much. But here we've got a good example of the stranger, that's me, giving an offering to God, and that being included with Israel. I love that a lot. That's a really awesome verse for me.
So again, this is a free will offering and burnt offering. It's not a sin offering, but we do see a male sheep. Now, it goes on to say, now, any of your sacrifices, again, like the Kohen that approaches the holy things of the Lord, must be without defect. So too, the sacrifice must be without defect.
Yeah, it's nearly exactly the same. It's nearly exactly the same. When you go through the list of the things that are a problem, the same
problems. It says your sheep shall not have eyebrows that are too long, and you can't have a dwarf sheep or a hunchback. Actually, I don't have any of that. I've got, if it's blind or it's broken or it's maimed, if it has an ulcer, eczema, scabs, whatever. You can't use that.
Right, but there's lesions. There's, in 23, mismatching limbs. There are problems with the eyes, problems with broken skin. And later on, in 24, let's just skip to 24. People can read the two in between.
You shall not offer to the Lord what is bruised or crushed.
Wait, it gets worse. Oh. I've got any animal whose testicles were squashed.
You've got squashed?
Squashed.
Crushed, you can't use testicles and squashed in the same sentence.
Pulled out. Or severed. You shall not offer up to the Lord in your land. You shall not do it.
No, I'm going to another translation. All right. This is the Jewish study Bible. This is verse 24. You shall not offer to the Lord anything with his testes bruised or crushed or torn or cut. Oh, man. And of course you shouldn't, but you shall not have. And you should look after your animals a bit better, people. You know,
it strikes me that these things are kind of a foot off the ground at all times. You'd have to, what are they doing?
Going to another translation.
Perfectly fine legs, but how are you going to, what are they doing to these animals?
I know. Oh. Even with the goats, right? My goats, they would always, they jostle, they do, with their horns and whatnot. Never had a problem like that. Mm. But 22, 24 in the art scroll, it does say, one whose testicles are, that are squeezed, crushed, torn, cut, you shall not offer to Hashem, nor shall you. Now, by the way, nor shall you do these in the land. Now, the interesting thing about that is it permissible to weather a goat or a sheep? It's because to ring them, to put so what happens, a lot of people, because you just can't have too many bucks. If you have too many bucks, they're going to fight and it's going to be chaos. And or rams, for example, and it's an absolute mess. You've got to separate them. And you just can't have a whole lot of separate flocks of sheep unless you've got the land to be able to do that. So you've just got to, most farmers think, well, I'll weather the sheep or the whatever cattle it is, and they will put a ring when the animal is young, put a ring around its testicles, and eventually it just drops off. And that animal doesn't develop like it's a eunuch, if you like. It doesn't develop like a buck or a ram or a bull. And that's the way but it says here in this verse, and this verse suggests there's a Torah against doing that.
So what do you do? I don't know. Maybe you just eat that livestock.
That's the remedy. You either earmark that male as a potential offering, a potential sacrifice, or you earmark that animal. Now, when I say earmark, that's funny, actually, because that's what they do. They actually put a an earring, if you like, in the ear and number the animal. Generally, that's what happens. You wouldn't be able to do that because that would make the animal not perfect. But so when I say earmark that animal, you set that animal aside for either sacrifice for your own food at home or for slaughter at home or a sacrifice at the temple. And that is a perfectly legitimate and pragmatic way of keeping those numbers down so you don't have that problem.
Yeah, it seems to me if you're farming to make a living, to make a sustainable income off livestock, and you breed a load of males and they're good for you, they're just causing you grief and causing kind of, because it's got to cost money, right? You've got to feed these animals and you're not ever going to get anything back off them except for an upset. Then absolutely they have to turn into goat pie.
Yeah, like goat pie. And then the Lord spoke to Moses saying, when a bull or a sheep or a goat is born, it shall be 7 days with its mother, and from the eighth day and thereafter it shall be accepted as a male, as an offering made by fire to the Lord. Now, there's a reason for that as well, because if you take an animal off its mother after she's given birth, and there's nothing to take the colostrum from her, then she's probably going to get mastitis. That's a whole other problem again. And the least that you can do is allow that that new kid or new lamb or calf to suckle from its mother and relieve her. You can't just, you just can't. It's not good practice just to take it off off the mother. Whether it's a cow or ewe, do not kill both her and her young on the same day. And whether you offer a sacrifice of thanksgiving to the Lord, offer it of your own free will. On the same day it shall be eaten, and you shall leave none of it until morning. I am the Lord. Again, we spoke about that. Leave none of it till morning. 31. You shall keep my commandments. You shall perform them. I am the Lord. You shall not profane my holy name, but I will be hallowed among the children of Israel. I am the Lord who sanctifies you. I brought you out of the land of Egypt. Be your God. I am the Lord. Wow. There's some emphasis.
Can we, just for a second, I want to go back to 29. So when it, in 29 it says, when you slaughter a thanksgiving offering to the Lord, you shall slaughter it so it should be acceptable for you. Now, we'd expect that really to say it should, it will be acceptable to the Lord, right? I mean, that's, you want to slaughter it that the animal is acceptable to God, that the way you slaughter it is acceptable to God. And it's kind of a confusing phrase, but when we finish off the verse, we read that the Lord, the Creator, wants you to eat that on the same day. He wants you to keep all of the instructions he's given you before them. And so for that to be acceptable to you, you have to place your care of both the animal and of the way it was killed and of the manner that you eat it above what your normal human nature might say. So, you know, you, it might be just good enough, or you might have a little bit tomorrow, but it's saying that you should absolutely kill this animal in the way that God's prescribed. You should eat it in the way that God's prescribed so that it's acceptable to you, that you know you're doing your best. And I think that's something worth mentioning. And one other part in 31, and we're trying to keep this short, but I made a ton of notes, so I'm going to use them all. You shall keep my commandments and perform them. I am the Lord. So I'm going to ask you a question. You shall keep my commandments. Now, that doesn't, when we say keep in English, what does that denote to you when we say
So to me, that means you shall obey my commandments.
And perform them. So it's telling you the same thing twice?
Or you shall guard them and perform them? Is that, right. Is that better?
What about if you were keeping an appointment?
Yeah.
All right, so where I'm going is, I think that when we read, you shall keep my commandments, it literally means mind them. You shall remember them. You shall keep them on your mind, that you put them in your heart, that you understand them, that you, so there's obviously the performance element of them is super important. There's no point remembering all the rules of the road and then just driving crazy style, the wrong way down the motorway. Just because you understand the law doesn't mean that, you know, you don't have to keep it. But I think what this is referencing is that you shall keep my commandments on your mind. You shall keep my commandments in your heart and understand them and live by them and perform them. I think that's the perform part is interesting. I mean, why not just say I should keep my commandments? I am the Lord. That would have, no, it's exactly the same thing. I think there is an emphasis there on trying to keep them at the front of your mind. I mean, we spoke last week, I think, on the issues of being a vegetarian and going through cans and finding stuff that's okay to eat. And when we get to Passover every year, you're obviously checking everything to see if it's got yeast in it. And that, I think, is keeping that commandment to its fullest degree. Everything that goes in your mouth, you've checked. And I think in this instance, it's asking you to make sure that every action that you fulfill, whether you be a priest or you be someone that's offering something to a priest, you're keeping the instruction you've been given so far so you can perform them because your God asks you to.
If I were to say, be mindful of my commandments and do them.
Yeah, I think that'd be a really good translation, yeah.
There we go. Chapter 23. Now, this is the feasts of the Lord. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feasts of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts. But it begins with Shabbat. And Shabbat's not a feast.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? That's the first one. And I think what this is kind of a two faces of the same coin. Now, we're going to read underneath this chapter about these other holy convocations and these holy days, these events and these parties, if you like, that you get a chance to get involved with, where you can honor your creator the way he wants you to. And it starts off with the Shabbat. And I think it's so you understand how important Shabbat is, but also how important the feasts are, that they're two sides of the same coin, that you shouldn't look at the feasts more importantly, you know, like with Shabbat tomorrow, but I really have to get some stuff for Passover. No, you know, it's not how it works. The Sabbath is a feast that you can have every week. I mean, this is going to sound really bad, but you know, some 5 years ago, when maybe 6 years ago now, when we'd come out of the church and we were looking at everything that our lifestyle was like, and Christmas was still on the calendar, right? It was never a religious holiday for us, but it was a good time to get lots of presents and to watch lots of good films and to eat lots of food. You know, it was Christmas, and it was Santa Christmas, Santa Claus Christmas, and we gave that up. And suddenly there was this hole at that time of the year, which normally would be enjoyment. There's a big countdown, you know, there's a big countdown for for getting together with people and having a fun time and a few glasses of whiskey and everything's shiny and there's lights and it's beautiful and it's lovely to look at. And now that wasn't there anymore. And not only that, but because of that, there's going to be issues with people that you know and family members that still do this. And, you know, you've got to explain things and it's awkward. But as we got more and more into the Hebrew texts and we started to look up Shabbat, and I think you'll find that there are two key things which generally get people out of churchianity, if you like. One of them is the decision they make to make that prayer that says, look, I really think you're there, God, but I'm not sure about this Jesus thing. I'll do whatever you want. Just tell me what the truth is. Lead me in that direction. That's the prayer that most people have made, that declaration to God. And the other is Shabbat. When people start to keep Shabbat, things happen.
And that's exactly what happened to us, by the way. It was Shabbat.
Right. And so as we got more into Shabbat, Shabbat became a bigger and bigger deal every week. And I had this conversation with somebody. I know, and I always feel bad about saying it, but, you know, it's what I said, and I still hold it to be a kind of a truth. And the Shabbat for us is like not having to wait 365 days for a Christmas. You know, it's Shabbat, and then the next day is the beginning of a brand new week, and I only have to wait another 6 days and it's Shabbat again. And we get the food and the rest and the fun and the, you know, the time we get to spend with God and look at his word and the closeness you know, as a married couple, the closeness we have doing that together and to be able to set that time apart specifically for God for a day, and that he's given that. What a gift that is. You know, it's not like getting a microwave every year. And we get this amazing gift from God every week. And so what I think the reason for its inclusion, to go back to the text, the reason for its inclusion at the beginning here is to highlight the importance of Shabbat and then the importance of the feasts underneath. If it had been the other way around, I wonder whether people would have said, well, you know, to put Shabbat at the end, maybe it's not so important as the rest of these things. We should really concentrate on the big holy occasions, and, you know, Shabbat we can kind of forget about. But so that's it. I think in short, Shabbat's included in these holy feasts because Shabbat is a set apart day and it is a holy feast in itself.
It's a funny thing, because I remember having a conversation years ago because, you know, as I mentioned, Shabbat was the discovery that began that running of the thread that eventually dismantled the New Testament for us. And because it just continues to lead to other things, and it's amazing, you know, how your life changes when you begin to keep Shabbat, particularly when you're coming out of the church. But I remember having a conversation years ago during that time with an SDA, a Seventh-day Adventist elder, and we were discussing certain things. And I said, look, so you keep the Sabbath, you know, in a way, why don't you keep the other set apart days that you read about, for example, in Leviticus 23? To which he stopped and he looked up and in a thoughtful way, and then he looked at me and he said, I don't know.
Hmm.
And I thought, that's interesting. All right, then. So,
at least he didn't come up with some crazy excuse and he just admitted
it. No, he just, it's like as if the first time he ever really thought of it. No, I think he even said, you know, I've thought about that before, but I don't know. Anyway, but this is just what we do as SDAs.
Mm-hmm.
But this Leviticus 23, the next one on the list, because for us, we were thinking, well, what else is there in the Old Testament, like Shabbat, that we should be doing, that we should be educating ourselves on and implementing? And, of course, that's what happened. Now, the next one on the list is Pesach and unleavened bread, Passover and unleavened bread, which we've just passed, right?
Right. It wasn't that long ago. Now we're doing the Omer at the moment for those, you know, in real time.
We're counting the Omer. After that, in the New King James, I've got the Feast of First Fruits. And the next one after that is the Feast of Weeks. Now, Shavuot, that's where we're approaching. We're counting the Omer. And it says, you shall count for yourselves from the day after Shabbat, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, seven Sabbaths shall be appointed. Count 50 days to the day after the seventh Shabbat. Then you shall offer a new grain offering to the Lord. You shall bring from your dwellings two wave loaves of 2/10 of an ephah. They shall be of fine flour. They shall be baked with leaven. They are first fruits to the Lord, and you shall offer with the bread seven lambs of the first year. Now, this is interesting because you read these things and you think, wow, you know, we're approaching Shavuot. What are we supposed to do for Shavuot? We don't have the temple. Mm. You know, what of all of, I mean, we don't do these sacrifices. I mean, I suppose you can memorialize the two loaves. It says there is a sin offering. Oh, look. Look, verse 19. You shall sacrifice one kid of the goats as a sin offering and two male lambs of the first year as a sacrifice of a peace offering. Oh, we were close.
We were close.
Peace offering. And the priest shall wave them and so on and so forth. They shall be holy to the Lord for the priests, and you shall proclaim on that same day. It is now, it's a holy convocation, right? So it's a day that you do no customary work. It shall be a statute forever in all your dwellings throughout your life. So you're not doing, what we do know is that there's no work to be done on that day.
No.
That day you take off.
Regular work. You read customary work, and I have not perform any work of labor. I think that's paid work. Or it's not something that you're going to sweat over. I think that there are some elements of physical labor that are allowed. It's a very iffy thing, but it's not the same as a regular Shabbat, which is why it says you should not perform any works of labor, and it situates labor at the end because, you know, it doesn't say you should not perform any work. That's a Shabbat ruling. I think the labor thing is specifically saying hard work.
And when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field. Here's a repetition here. Mm. When you reap, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest, you shall leave them for the poor and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God. Why? Because it's that time of the year.
Mm.
There it is. The next one after that, the Feast of Trumpets. That's the first day in the seventh month.
I think that's probably one of my favorite ones.
You like that?
Yeah, well, physically, there's not an awful lot to do except for make a lot of noise. And I kind of like making a lot of noise. And I got a shofar a couple of years ago. Yeah, you get to
mix. There you go.
Yeah, wake the neighbors, you know. Some people say it's a feast of shouting. So
no, you can't wake the neighbors. Do you know there's actually a verse in Proverbs, I think. I hope I get this right, I'm paraphrasing. He who wakes his neighbor early in the morning, it shall be counted a curse to him.
Well, only by their neighbors. And they should be up. It's a Feast of Trumpets, for crying out loud.
All right. So that's the day of blowing, I think, more literally. And following that, most important, the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, and we spoke about that just in previous Torah portion as to what went on there.
I think that was last week, actually, wasn't it? People can go back and look at that. Yeah.
So the Day of Blowing, Feast of Trumpets, you shall do no customary work again.
This says, it's the Day of Atonement. It should be a holy convocation for you. You shall afflict yourselves and shall offer up fire offering to the Lord, and you should do no work on that day, for it's a day of atonement.
And so you fast on that day. Mm-hmm. The Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot.
Sukkot.
Is what follows, the 15th day of the 7th month. And of course, everyone knows that's when you build your sukkah.
That's right.
You dwell in your sukkah for a week.
If you can. I'm still waiting for an opportunity and the land to be able to build a sukkah and spend quality time in it.
You spend a little bit more time out on your little balcony.
That's right, on a little balcony, yeah. And I remember the first year we did this, we went to the in-laws with a tent, which was interesting because it got a real mixed response from people. You know, the tent's not right. You didn't erect it. You have to be able to see the stars. I thought, give me the plot and bring me the wood and then I'll see what I can do. But yeah. I remember it was freezing cold, and that year it fell in October, and it was something like 2 degrees, and I had a cold, and it was miserable, and not at all what I envisioned it to be.
Hoping it would be, yeah.
When 3 months before I bought the tent, you know, I thought it's going to be lovely, yeah. You know, but no, it wasn't. But having done it, having spent all of those nights outside in nature, every night we did it. And there was one particular night, I think we were 5 nights in, I had a honking cold. I thought I could die now. I feel so ill. And I turned over to my wife, who normally is so careful when it comes to illness, you know, that I said, I really don't feel well. I think we should go in. It was something 3 or 4 in the morning. I felt that that was close enough to dawn to, you know, it wouldn't be a strike. And she said, we've done 5 nights. And we're not doing this for us. We're doing this to show our creator how much we love him, you know, which is why, that's why anyone does tour, I think. And she said, and you want to waste that for like 2 hours inside a central heated house? And so we stuck with her, and we did the rest of the week.
And stuck it out. Wow.
And it didn't feel like we'd achieved something that made us feel better about ourselves. But it was the first difficult part of our walk where we physically felt that we couldn't do something, and we stuck to it. And after that, everything else we'd come across, every kind of difficult little bump or hill, we just said, no, we're going to buckle on. Because, you know, if you really want to do Torah, it's not hard. You know, you make it hard. You think it's going to be hard. You think, you know, you're going to come across difficulties, whether they be, you know, financial or personal, or your relationships with your family. And some people have really horrendous issues with their family, especially if they come from a very religious family that doesn't understand what they're doing. And people get cast off, and it's terrible. But if you keep your eyes focused on your creator and what he wants you to do, and you know, just don't worry about the peripherals, then you can get through it. And that was the lesson we learned.
I can relate to your story, though, and I'm not as enduring as you, I suppose, maybe. But, you know, in the Southern Hemisphere, it's a different – it's not autumn. It's spring. It's not fall. It's spring. And in spring, at that time of the year, I get horrid hay fever. And being out in the country and being surrounded by fields of, you know, canola and wheat and everything. I mean, it's just the hay fever, the pollen count in the air is just incredible. And I only have to be outside for, you know, 10 minutes before my face begins to melt. and it's, if I was to stay out at night, I don't know what would happen to me. We make the effort to build the sukkah because, unfortunately, my son, my youngest son, also suffers from, he inherited it from me. But my eldest son and Khani, they can get out there. We do make the effort to build it. I take a whole lot of antihistamines and we build a sukkah and we're out as much as we can, and we try to eat out there. But I can't stay. I can't sleep.
I suppose the caveat is that we are not a nation within a homeland doing this as a group. I mean, you look there at 36 for a 7-day period, you should offer a fire offering to the Lord. That's not something we can do, you know. And so much of what we've actually just read, we can't do 100%. But I think you should always do what you are physically able to do. But if that involves your nose dissolving over your top lip with hay fever, then you have to take a step back.
Oh yeah, no, it's not pretty. But again, you know, in Israel, and may it be one day that I'm in Israel over Sukkot. I would love that, and I would definitely love to dwell in a booth for all of that time, and I won't have that problem. Mm. And so may it be sometime soon. Chapter 24, this is the care of the tabernacle lamps. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the children of Israel that they may bring you pure oil of pressed olives for the light, to make the light burn continually outside the veil of the testimony in the tabernacle of meeting. Aaron shall be in charge of it from evening until morning before the Lord continually. It'll be a statute forever in your generations. He'll be in charge of the lamps and the pure gold lampstand before the Lord continually.
Yeah, what do you get there? What do you get? What's your understanding of the pure menorah? Oh, you've got pure gold? All right, so the text says literally.
Well, gold's pure. Not really. It's in italics, so gold's not there. It just says the pure lampstand.
So there's an understanding there that either it refers to the pure gold, or that this using the pure oil, or mm-hmm. that the menorah itself was pure, that it would be completely cleaned before, you know, of all the detritus from the previous use, the ashes and everything else. Just skip back into verse 2. Pure olive oil is different to regular olive oil. Olive oil was, the olives are normally crushed 2 or 3, 4 times. The first press was the pure olive oil. I think it's the same today with when you get first press of olive oil, it's the premium olive oil.
Uh-huh. Okay. And the next passage is about the bread of the tabernacle. You shall take fine flour, bake 12 cakes with it. 2/10 of an ephah shall be in each cake. You shall set them aside in 2 rows, 6 in a row, on the pure, and I've got gold again in italics, table before the Lord. And you shall put pure frankincense on each row, that it may be on the bread for the memorial, an offering made by fire to the Lord. Every Shabbat he shall set it in order before the Lord continually, being taken from the children of Israel by an everlasting covenant. It shall be for Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in a holy place, for it is most holy to him from the offerings of the Lord made by fire by a perpetual statute.
Isn't that kind of cool? Isn't that cool? Because we get we often hear from certain groups that unless you kill an animal for a sacrifice, your repentance doesn't count. That if you want to give a sin offering or a guilt offering, it has to be an animal, there has to be blood. And yet here we are. It shall be to Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in the holy place. It is the holy of holies for him. So the bread was the most important. It's the holiest food. And then he eats it in the holiest place. It's not a chicken wing or a burger or a steak. It was it's the bread. And I think that's way cool. It's really great to know that the poorest person in the camp could offer the holiest offering.
I'm glad you brought that up, because, of course, in the English here, I've got, for it is most holy. But you're right. It said it is holy of holies to him.
Mm.
Cool. Now, our Torah portion finishes, the last passage, with a bit of a story.
Yeah, it's real odd. It just changes direction.
Totally changes here, and we have a little story. So it says, now the son of an Israelite woman whose father was an Egyptian. Stop and think about that for a second. The son of an Israelite woman whose father was an Egyptian went out among the children of Israel, and this Israelite woman's son and a man of Israel fought each other in the camp. Now, interesting that it refers to him as, it doesn't refer to him as an Israelite. This Israelite woman's son and a man of Israel fought each other in the camp, and the Israelite woman's son blasphemed the name of Yehovah, of the Lord, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, and cursed. And so they brought him to Moses. His mother's name was Shelomit. I've got here the daughter of Dibri, of the tribe of Dan. She's of the tribe of Dan. And then they put him in custody that the mind of the Lord might be shown to them. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take outside the camp him who has cursed, and let all who heard him lay their hand on his head, and let all the congregation stone him. And then you shall speak to the children of Israel, saying, whoever curses his God shall bear his sin, and whoever blasphemes the name of the Lord shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall certainly stone him, the stranger as well as him who was born in the land. When he blasphemes the name of the Lord, he shall be put to death. the stranger as well as him who was born in the land.
Yeah, I've got actually in mine, in my one there, I've actually got the convert and the resident alike. So it's it's substituted stranger for convert, which it hasn't done up to this point.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's GER, it's G-E-R, so it would have been, it's pronounced or translated stranger nearly everywhere
who
else.
Has joined, someone who was not an Israelite, but has joined himself to...
Yeah, as we were saying earlier, you've got the children of Israel, the children of Jacob, and then you've got the stranger that dwells within the gate, and that's the GER in this
that does infer that this person that this particular person that we're dealing with is a GER, right? Would you agree?
Why?
Because his father is Egyptian.
That's right. Yeah, and the heritage of the child comes through the father, and I think we've got a text reference for that in my notes. If you could just give me a second.
The first one that comes to my mind is Numbers chapter 1, verse 18, I think it is.
You know, I think Numbers is ringing a bell, so it's probably the same one.
It says, and they assembled all the congregations together on the first day of the second month, and they recited their ancestry by families, by their fathers.
That's
by
it.
Their fathers' houses, according to the number of names from 20 years old and above, each one individually.
And Numbers 2:2, the children of Israel shall encamp each man to his grouping according to the signature of his father's household. So we know that the father was Egyptian. So now the son of an Israelite woman, and he was the son of an Egyptian man, that says in my text, went out among the children of Israel. I mean, what does went out mean? So often we read through a line and we skip phrases, which... Yeah, we just assume non-phrases. Went out among the children of Israel. Surely he's already among the children of Israel. Why is that a big deal? And they quarreled in the camp, this son of the Israelite woman and an Israelite man. So what are they arguing about? I can tell you that the traditional understanding of this is that he went out from his mother's tent and pitched the tent among the people of Dan. And they said, you shouldn't be here. And he said, I absolutely should be here. My mother comes from the tribe of Dan, and they said that's not how it works, and there was a fight. That's the traditional understanding of the text. And during that fight, he mentioned the name of the creator and cursed, not necessarily cursed the name of the creator, and so they brought him to Moses. What that infers to me is that he maybe mentioned the name of God and cursed the person, not necessarily that he cursed the name of God, but his actions were, if you like, a curse on the name of God, just like earlier on.
And in any case, he misused it. He used the name of God in a way that it should not be used.
Yeah.
Treated it lightly. Yeah.
But it's the actions. Just like for the last three chapters, you get a list of instruction and you are to try and keep those instructions. And if you don't, then you're bringing the name of God down. You're misappropriating your involvement in Israel, and you're making the light that you should be dimmer. And that only affects God. You know, it's just like when Israel was brought out of Egypt, and they were saying, well, you know, what are the nations going to say that we were brought out here to die? That's just going to make you look bad. That's what Moses said to God. And that's kind of what's inferred in this. You have to be the best person you can because you're an ambassador for the king of the universe. And this guy, I think, caused a ruckus. And because of that, he, in his actions, proved himself unworthy.
Absolutely. So it continues on. It does say, whoever kills a man shall surely be put to death. Whoever kills an animal shall make it good, animal for animal. If a man causes disfigurement of his neighbor as he has done, so shall it be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, and as he caused a disfigurement of a man, so shall it be done to him. Whoever kills an animal shall restore it, but whoever kills a man shall be put to death. You shall have the same law for the stranger and for the one of your own country. I am the Lord your God. Then Moses spoke to the children of Israel, and they took outside the camp him who had cursed and stoned him with stones, so that the children of Israel did as the Lord commanded Moses. That is the way our Torah portion ends.
It's pretty hardcore, isn't it? I mean, we know. I mean, I don't know. You might. This might be the first time a listener's listened to the show, but when the text says an eye for an eye, that's not inferred. And what's inferred is that if a person loses an eye, the person that causes that to happen is financially responsible for the restitution of what the eye is worth to that person's work. It doesn't actually mean you pluck someone's eye out. If it did...
Because with an animal, it says you shall make good. Well, you can do that. Yeah. I mean, okay, so I was responsible for the death of this animal, but I have another sheep, and here it is. But you can't very well go, well, I have another eye. There right. It is.
And what would that mean? That Israel would be a wandering tribe of one-armed, one-eyed, toothless people, because every time they got into a fight, someone else would end up, you know, what's the point of two people getting maimed? It just doesn't work that way. So yeah, there was a financial restitution made for each accident, and that probably varied. If you were if you pressed grapes, then and you lost a foot, that's your whole livelihood gone. So I imagine that would be more expensive than someone that maybe lost a finger.
Sure. And what does it serve the person? I mean, now listen, if I was responsible for the loss of someone's eye, how does that person, I mean, does that person feel vindicated? Does it make them feel any better if I pluck out my own eye? Or does it restore them if I financially reimburse them for the loss of their eye?
Yep. I mean, this whole group is about the preservation of themselves. And they are a band of people who are trying to live off the land while moving in the land towards the home that they've been promised. They're not about making a bigger tent or getting a new iPad. It was about living from day to day and working as a group to make that happen. So yeah, you're right. It wouldn't have done anyone any good for some extra person to lose an eye, but everyone good to help that person keep a sustainable lifestyle.
So we tried to keep it to 15 minutes, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. We did terribly at that.
Yeah. It's more like an hour and 15 minutes. Jason of spiritualbabies.net, thank you, my friend, for coming back onto Torah Pearls on Truth to You. And don't forget, we are going on tour, dear listeners. We're going on tour with Ross Nichols of rootsoffaith.org and Rabbi Tovia Singer of outreachjudaism.org. We're going to be in the land on the 2nd of November. If you would like to join us, there's only a few seats left on the bus, so you're going to have to be quick because they're filling up pretty quickly. But there are a few left. You can get the details by going to truthtoyou.org. There's a link on this post. Otherwise, just go to the website and follow the links and get a deposit in to secure your seat. We would love to see you there. It's going to be great. Yep.
Yeah, it's going to be way cool. And we're going to, it's a Tanakh-only tour. We're going to be visiting a ton of places, which we probably have covered, or we will certainly cover by the end of the Torah cycle. And we're going to be doing Bible studies on the spot. And Toby is going to be there, so you can pick his brains. And it's going to be a lot of fun. So go and place your deposits, get the seat. There's a few seats left. If you mention this Torah portion in your deposit, we won't give you the crappy seats that are left. We'll give you the good seats, and we'll move
across. Crappy seats.
Yeah, the ones at the back.
No, I love the ones at the back.
No, you at the back.
You're telling me I've always been sitting in the crappy seats all this time.
You want to be at the front, the panorama view.
I like the ones at the back. I'm going to be hanging with the cool people at the back.
All right, fair enough. So mention this Torah portion. You can sit with Jono at the back. I'll be
there
at the front of Tovia. It's fine. People can make their own choices. I'm not saying there's a division, but there's clearly
I'll sit
a division.
At the back. Okay. Until next time, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom. Yeah, I totally sit at the back. I don't know why, but I'm just like the back of the bus.
I bet you were that kind of kid at school. You know, you wore your tie a little bit looser than everybody else.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. If I wore it at all.